Hi, this is Peter Gethers, author of My Mother's Kitchen, Breakfast, Lunch, Dinner, and the Meaning of Life. As I hope you know by now, I've stepped in to host the Clever Cookster podcast this month. Today we have a terrific guest for you, Melissa Clark, a staff reporter for the New York Times food section, for which she writes the column A Good Appetite, and appears in a weekly cooking video series. Melissa is also the author of a truly great new cookbook, Dinner, Changing the Game. Hello, Melissa.
Hello, Peter.
You are one of the most prolific food writers I have ever encountered since I have watched your career over the years. How many cookbooks have you actually written, or do you even know?
At last count, it was 38. I don't think I missed any.
I haven't even read 38 cookbooks. You've written 38 cookbooks?
They go so fast.
What was the first? How did you get started doing this?
Well, the very first cookbook I wrote was the Bread Machine Cookbook, and it was a little mass market paperback, and it was 1993, and I was in grad school. And I was also, I had a little catering company up at Columbia University where I went to grad school. So a friend of a friend said, oh, you have a catering company, and you're in grad school, you're getting your MFA, so you can write and you can cook. Can you please write a cookbook? This is, my friend has a book packaging company, and the woman who was supposed to write this Bread Machine cookbook pulled out. Can you do it in 6 weeks? And I'd never written a cookbook in my life, so of course I said, sure.
Of course.
Because that's snap. One of the things, you know, when you're that young, you just think you can do anything. But I did do it. I got four bread machines. I had them going 24 hours a day. I would get up for the 4 o'clock in the morning feedings. You know, you take bread out, put the new stuff in. And I actually produced this cookbook in 6 weeks. I hope this isn't going to be the case, because I hope my new cookbook will do even better. But up till now, it's sold more cookbooks than all of my other ones combined.
The bread
machine that I got no royalties on, because, you know, this is
I guarantee you the new cookbook's going to sell a lot more than that. You heard it here first. So then I know you've also worked with a lot of chefs.
Yes.
You did a lot of co-writing
yes,
cookbooks.
Which I love to do.
So how did that then happen? And actually what I really want to know is, because I'm obsessed with how people write cookbooks, is from a cookbook standpoint, what did you learn, either positively or negatively, from chefs about writing cookbooks?
Oh, I learned so much. Most of it was positive. I mean, I had some negative experiences, but nothing, I wouldn't say that there was sort of a negative lesson that I learned.
What I mean is, are chefs so tied into their specific recipe that you don't have room to maneuver?
You know, and again, you can't really generalize, because each chef is different and each process was different. What I really tried to do was to work with the chef the way that the chef was most comfortable, because I feel like I got best results. So I started out working with Sylvia Woods from Sylvia's up in Harlem. And the last...
I use her canned field peas, by the way, to this day. They're so good.
She was so lovely. I just loved working with her. And, you know, for her, it was her whole family. What we wanted to do was get her family stories. So I would go. I was living in Brooklyn, in the same house I'm living in right now, and I would take the 2 train up to Harlem, to 125th Street. It was an hour. And she and I would talk, and I would tape record her. I would tape record her stories and all her family's stories. And then before I left, she always would give me 2 giant containers full of food to take home. And, you know, not for me. It was always for my husband.
It
was like, oh, you have to feed your husband. So she'd give me, you know, oxtails and collard greens and macaroni and cheese. And I'd sit with this fragrant hot food on my lap for an hour. My stomach would be growling. Everybody on the subway would be looking at me until I could finally get home to Brooklyn to eat it. But what was great about Sylvia was that I learned how to capture someone's voice. And not just her voice, but the voice of every member of her family, because they all told the story together. And really using the tape recorder was just that. I spent so many hours transcribing, but I got their voices in my head, and that was really helpful. And so I applied that lesson to every other book that I learned, because when you're doing a chef's book, it's not just getting their recipes, it's getting their voice and their stories, and that's really important.
So is it different now you're doing your own cookbooks? So is it hard adapting and finding your own voice, or that was natural for you?
No, that was hard, because every cookbook has a voice. It's not just my voice. I don't think I'm the only one who's schizophrenic. We all have a lot of different voices. You know, the voice we have. The voice that you call your mother on the phone with, and the voice that you
talk
to your best friend from
college.
And
what people don't understand when you're writing, especially nonfiction, you have to pick a voice.
Yes.
Especially like my book's a memoir. Well, and everything in it is true, but I had to invent my character as the person telling the story. You have to lock into who you are in this version. So it's the same for cookbooks.
Exactly. And I think people don't realize that. And I also think that it's something that I think that because you've written so many in so many different styles, I mean, you've written screenplays and you've written novels and you've written memoir. And you've
but enough about me.
No, but this is. But I think this is important to people because I've written for a lot of different publications. I have my Melissa writes for the New York Times voice. My Melissa writes her cookbook voice. And then all the other voices when I was freelance, Melissa writes for Martha Stewart.
Right.
Melissa writes for, you know, Time Out New York. And they're all different.
And it's hard finding your own real voice.
It is. Well, and again, I don't think you have
voices,
one.
Yeah.
It's part of the process is finding the voice you want to use for this particular project. And what I notice with bloggers is that, you know, they have, you know, when people start up blogging, they have one voice. And I think that it's really helpful for them to change. Mm-hmm. So that's always when people ask me for advice, that's some of the advice that I always give is, you know what, try to find another voice within yourself because that's fun and interesting. And I think it makes you a better writer, even if it's not going to be your primary writing style. Play with it and push yourself.
So yeah, I've written fiction and nonfiction. Nonfiction in some ways is easier because you're not really starting with a blank page because something mm-hmm. happened.
Yes.
Fiction, of course, you're starting with a blank page. When you were working with chefs, there was no blank page because, in a way, you had to conceptualize it, but their food was there in many instances. So when you're starting a new cookbook, again, you're writing a book called Dinner, mm-hmm. which I think I have to say is one of the great titles of all time. It's a great, great title. I can't believe there aren't 100 books not called Dinner because it's just perfect.
I think people give in to the temptation of adding lunch and breakfast
to
their books.
I guess, but Dinner is a perfect title. But you're starting with a blank page. I mean, dinners exist, but so how do you start creating and formulating what you want a book about dinner to be?
That was the hardest part of this process for this book because I knew what I wanted the recipes to be. I knew that these recipes needed to be interesting, something that people wouldn't have thought of on their own, but nothing complicated. The techniques needed to be super simple, like you get home from work and you know instinctively how to make this dish, but you're using flavors that you wouldn't have necessarily thought to put together. So that was, in every recipe, I tried to do that. So that was easier than trying to figure out, well, how do I talk about this? How do I tell this story? Because there's so many different ways. And my original concept was to have very, very short head notes and just let the... And almost
head notes, just... people read them all the time, but they may not know them as head notes. Explain what that means, actually.
It's the note right above the recipe. It's the information before the recipe starts. Sometimes it's a story. Sometimes it's information on ingredients or technique. And my original vision was two, three sentences, almost like a haiku. But my editor felt like that there was warmth lacking, that my warmth that comes across in my Times column was absent in this very short form. And I thought, well, it's easier for people. They'll just get what they need to know and they'll go on to the recipe.
It comes back to voice.
But right. And there wasn't enough voice. There wasn't enough of me. So then I didn't want to do it. I didn't want them to be too long because you know what? You've come home from work. You need to make dinner. You don't need to sit here reading, you know, mm-hmm. 400 words. So it was finding that right balance. And what was important for me is I decided not to make it formulaic. I tried to vary them up. So every bit of information, sometimes they tell a story quickly, you know, succinctly, and sometimes they're just informational. But I tried to make them all different, and that took so much work. Really, that was the longest part of the process. But it was also incredibly gratifying.
So now I have sort of a two-part question after listening to you talk, because I'm going back to something you said much earlier. So you did your first book when you were a graduate student.
Mm-hmm.
So I assume you're quite young, not that you're not young still.
Exactly.
So when did you find your palate? When did you know you had a good enough palate to trust it for actually going into food and cooking? Because I like to cook. I love to drink wine. I have no palate, and it drives me crazy.
Really?
Yeah. Your lovely agent, who I know extremely well, has the most perfect palate of anyone I've practically ever met. I know much, much more about wine than she does, for instance.
Right.
But I don't have a palate. She'll take a sip of wine and she'll go, oh, I taste the cherries and the dirt. And then this is obviously a Burgundy from this region. And I'm going, I taste wine. And it drives me crazy. And I mean, I have reasonably good taste, but I can't, say, deconstruct a dish or something.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
But you, when did you know you had that palate? And when did you have the confidence to really trust it?
That's such an interesting question. I don't know that I can pinpoint that time. When I first did
I mean, does it feel like you always had it?
I grew up in a foodie family, so we were always talking about food. We were always deconstructing the food that we were eating in restaurants at home, discussing it, I think, and just being really well practiced in being called upon to identify flavors. Can you taste the tarragon? Can you taste the cinnamon? Like, you start practicing that at a really early age, and it just becomes part of you. So mm-hmm. that was always part of me.
I had that too, but I never became part of me.
That's funny. Yeah. I don't know. And so as far as confidence goes, I mean, I wrote this first book having no experience, not knowing what I was doing, because I was too young and stupid to know that I shouldn't do mm-hmm. it. So that was good, I guess. I mean, it got me something. And then I did another couple of books because they kept sending me checks. And I said, okay, I'm going to keep doing this. And then I got the reputation of being somebody who hands in work on time. Very important, hand in your stuff relatively on time.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And
another lesson I haven't really learned, by the way. But
and it's just that, and in a way, that was, no one questioned my palate. It just never came up. And I just assumed that I could do it, and I kept doing it. I think when, you know, it's been the more recipes published under my own name, when I got the column in the New York Times and I started getting feedback from people, I made this and it was delicious. Oh my God, this thing was so good, and I learned this technique. That's when I really started to realize, oh, you know what? I have something to offer. I have something to offer people in that I can help them, you know, cook real food. I want people to cook more, and I can help them do that.
All right. So along that line, this is one of the things, again, you're our guest, but I would never say this. I love this book. It's a truly great book, I think. And one of the things that I love about it, it takes normal recipes, but almost every single one, in fact, maybe every single one, has a twist to it,
mm-hmm.
and it comes back to palate. So you're going to hear rustling pages for a second, because I have to find this. So here's a perfect example. Roasted turkey breast
mm-hmm.
with rosemary's and anchovies.
Yes.
So I love anchovies. I would never, if I were just in my kitchen, and I go, oh, look, I have a turkey breast. I can roast it. It would never occur to me to put anchovies on it. So how do you, for all these recipes, come up with something that's basically a simple, normal thing that people can do when they come home from work?
Right.
And yet you've used your palate to add a little twist to it.
Okay.
Where does that twist come from?
You know, it's funny because as you were speaking, I was just thinking, why did I put anchovies on it? And I was thinking, well, anchovies, because turkey breast is really boring, and I'd really rather be eating lamb. Pretty much, and what's really good with lamb? Anchovies. The Italians always put anchovies with lamb. So I'm sure that it's like this free associating. It's like being in psychoanalysis. You are free associating in your kitchen. You're like, turkey breast. Oh, I wish it were lamb. Lamb, rosemary, and anchovies. Oh, hey, that's good on turkey breast, too. And it makes it taste almost as good as lamb.
All right, so I think all of our listeners like to cook. And I'm guessing most of our listeners have also been in psychoanalysis. So, or if not, they will be after I'm done hosting the podcast. So that's a really, really valuable tip. It's partly trust your instincts, trust your palate. You won't go wrong for the most part if you put in what you like.
Exactly. If you're starting with good, I always say, if you're starting with good ingredients and you don't burn the house down, it's a success.
Well, I think that's the most valuable thing anybody can hear from a cooking standpoint. And thank you, Melissa. For past episodes of Clever Cookster, check us out on iTunes, Stitcher, Spotify, Quick, and DirtyTips.com, my favorite name for a .com. Or wherever you listen to podcasts. And don't forget to check out my new book, My Mother's Kitchen, Breakfast, Lunch, Dinner, and the Meaning of Life, available from all book retailers. And definitely check out Melissa's new book, Dinner.